So, this is your co-pilot again. We are now beginning our long, gradual descent. Still keep those seat belts fastened. Still a little bit left. We never know if the last of the bumpy ride is behind us or not. I'd like to give a completely, utterly serious, dignified Dharma talk, but that's not going to happen. Not going to happen. So, at the end of a very, very long rain season retreat, the Venerable Ajahn Mahabingo, who has been contemplating anatta and the absence of any lasting self, is so moved by the 3 months of inner contemplation of the changing sensations that are going on within and the lack of any core identity, that after 3 months of this practice, he falls down before the statue of the Buddha and he goes, I am no one. I am nothing. I am an empty vessel. I am no one. Seeing this, his venerable assistant, Putra, this is what's coming up. Putra falls prostrate beside him before the Buddha. I, who am no one, I am nothing. I am an empty vessel to be filled. I am no one. Seeing this moving display of the purest form of spirituality, the janitor at the hall puts down his mop and walks beside them, falling prostrate himself. I am no one. I am nothing. I am an empty vessel. I am no one. At which point, the student, Putra, nudges the Ajahn and says, look who thinks he's no one. What? That's good material. What are you talking about? All right, Ajahn Mahabingo is walking a long walking meditation. And his walking meditation goes on for far longer than he ever imagined. He's crossed the border of Thailand into Burma, and he doesn't think very much of Burmese meditators, of the Sayadaws and the wonderful traditions there. He's always held them in a little bit low regard. And so he stumbles to his surprise on a sangha of Burmese meditators. And they're just walking around doing their chores, and they greet him. They say, welcome. And he says, oh, well, would you like to hear a good Burmese joke? And the Sayadaw says, well, before you tell this joke, I just want to let you know that I am Sayadaw, that this big guy over there, he's Burmese. Those three big monks, they're Burmese. The other guy back there, he's Burmese. Still want to tell that joke? To which the Ajahn replies, well, not if I have to explain it 5 times. Last one. Mahabingo is deep. I wrote these last night. Mahabingo is in deep deep meditation. And he's visited by two students of a very strict, very, very strict meditation master, Ajahn from the north, who follows the canon to the T, and they have to do hours of night sets, and regarded for the profound, profound strictness and hardcoreness of his practice. And the two students from this master come to see Ma Bingo, and they say, "We've got terrible news." And Ma Bingo goes, "What?" And he goes, our master has died." And Maha Bingo goes, "Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible." And he sits with the news for a moment, and then he says, "Well, did he have any last words?" And the one student thinks, and the other one nudges him and whispers. And then the first student goes, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, he said, could you please drop the gun?" Please drop the gun.
Tell him the light bulb on.
How many Vipassana meditators does it take to change a light bulb? None. You just know darkness, darkness, darkness. So we're beginning our transition. I think tomorrow we're going to be talking more about the importance of making the transition back to the world a very gradual one. Last year when Kathy and I left the retreat, I remember Kathy driving and the sensations. She was behind the wheel and I was sitting behind the dashboard like, you know, and the world was coming at us. And it was the most horrifying video game imaginable. Colors and shapes. So we got back to Williamsburg and we went to a restaurant that had choices of what to eat. It all seemed so extreme and magical at the same time that you could choose. You know, it wasn't just going to be delivered in a big bowl, you know, that you were going to. It was, you actually suddenly had choices, and there's colors everywhere, and there's sensations, and there's, you know, there's lights and stores and, you know, all that stuff. It's and it's best to it's already going to be quiet and experience. So I suggest, though, that you consider there's certain experiences that lie on the exact opposite end of the universe from mindfulness and inner peace. This place is called Facebook. It is a realm where nothing deep, where nothing enriching to the soul occurs, where everything is ephemeral and everything's about seeking approval outside of ourselves and sharing all that is meaningless to everybody. And as you make your journey from your peaceful state to Facebook, I encourage it to be a gradual one. You're not going to give me the laugh? Do we need a doctor? Okay. Nice. There's a temptation to think of meditation, spiritual practice is just one more ball we're juggling. We've already got our exercise, our work, our relationships, families, if we have them, and all the stuff we're juggling in our lives. All these balls we're keeping up in the air. Our attention is divided. How am I going to pay these bills and go to this job maintain this relationship and this and that? And then suddenly we're tossed another ball. Oh yeah, you gotta meditate every day. And if that's the case, the meditation and the practice will be the first ball that we drop, because it's the ball that is the least rewarded by the rest of the world. People will love the balls you're keeping up in the air. Like, oh, you exercise, that's great. Ooh, you have a career, that's wonderful. Ooh, I love hearing about your this and your that and your that. But you try to show people the meditation ball, and they're like, I don't even know what that is. What happened to you on your retreat? Oh, I experienced great moments of inner peace and acknowledged things that had been blocked. Can you stop? Did you have any nice pictures? I mean, I... Yeah, post on Facebook, you know. So if it's just another ball, we're going to drop it. The truth is that spiritual practice is the stool that we sit on while we juggle. It is the thing that allows us to juggle at all. It is the thing that allows us to keep all those balls up in the air. Without that stool we sit on, the thing that gives us the foundation to actually have a center, a place to literally with ease keep track of all the stuff we're keeping up in the air, eventually all the balls we're juggling crash to the earth. We need to have a place that allows us to focus on our lives with ease. And that's what this transition is all about. When we go back, there's a tendency to lose the inner awareness. And while, of course, I encourage you to maintain a spiritual meditation practice, hopefully, at least, if possible, a half an hour a day. That's what I encourage members of our meditation communities. If you can't do that, whatever you can do, but on top of it, practicing mindfulness throughout the day is so important to maintaining that stool, that peace that allows us to be in our busy lives with our schedules and our hectic responsibilities. And what this means is in the shower, stop for a minute. Feel the sensations of the water going down the body. In the subway platform, you can feel the shifting of the weight from one foot to another, the sensations of waiting. What does that do to the body? What changes if we look for the subway, the car coming, or if we don't, if we live right now in the moment of waiting? Before we go into a meeting with somebody that stresses us out, can we take a moment and find where the fear, the apprehension is being held in the body? Can we scan and can we find these areas? Can we unwind them? Instead of bringing in a body of armor into our interactions, can we practice what we've been doing for these last 7 days of, before each appointment, just taking a moment to again and again try to release the body, the breath, to a neutral state, or as close to a neutral state as we can. When we leave work, rather than carrying it with us, can we take a moment to stop and literally stand somewhere and just feel and hear the sensations that are occurring right at that moment? Can we put down the stories of the day and actually open to what's happening now? Practicing these, bringing mindfulness into day-to-day life is, for me, one of the most essential parts of my spiritual path. Then there's the dealing with repeated obsessions, sensations that keep coming back. This is what happens with the busy, attached mind. It'll attach on to things, even things that are utterly meaningless. Before I was going to give a Dharma talk that I was really, really excited about, this happened a couple of months ago. G will remember this. I was standing outside trying to clear out my mind and just let go of everything that happened in the day. A saxophonist pulled out his saxophone. I thought, oh, okay, this could be good. Maybe he's going to do something by Coltrane or Ornette Coleman. And then, as he put the instrument to his lips, out came the refrain from Wham's Careless Whisper. In horror, the entirety of the Dharma was swept out of my mind and replaced with easily the four worst notes ever played in the history of mankind. I envisioned, in the wisdom of my spiritual practice, I envisioned going back in time and murdering the saxophonist who originally played those notes right before. And I said, no. I am enlightened now. All I would simply do is go back in time and bash his saxophone over a chair. But seriously, when this actually happened, the way I got back to a place where I could give a shambles of it, no, it was actually a fine talk, but was simply to say, yes, welcome, you too, George Michael, into my mind. even you, right now. No, anyway, saying yes, opening, greeting, rather than falling back into our patterns, our tendencies of trying to be averse and push away every sensation that we don't want to acknowledge or experience. This is not the way to peace. The way to peace is to bring this open-hearted, acknowledging quality. When we acknowledge things and allow them to arise, they also then pass. The resistance that we greet the sensations of the world is what keeps them going in our mind. That same energy that resists is what forms the fuel for the recurring and re-arising of sensations. Practicing compassion in the world, we've been sending out metta to all beings for 6 days now. We all want to practice it in the city. Guess what? Sometimes opening our hearts and being vulnerable can lead to difficult situations. I've often experienced that not everybody in the world is skillful. And yet, to throw away this compassion towards other beings, this gentleness that we develop, this sense of giving people space, of not breaking the boundaries of silence and allowing people to be in a truly environment free of sexual advances and promoting and advertising and pushing and being treated as an obstacle to other people. We've been free. We've been in a perfect or as close to a perfect environment as you can develop. And then we go back to the world. It's tempting to re-armor the heart and to go back to a place where there's very little empathy. In my experience, the key to keeping compassion and appreciation and metta towards friendliness, towards people, is the fourth part of the puzzle, which is balance, equanimity. This is the wisdom that lets us know, okay, I've tried, I've extended friendliness, but in this relationship, it's not working right now. Whatever the karma between us from the past or whatever that person's experienced in their life, they are not ready right now to receive my openness, my vulnerability, whatever friendliness they're not capable of. I might get into I got into an interaction with was on my bike with somebody right after I had was on a short 3-day workshop, and I immediately experienced just so much aggression, so much anger, and from the person towards me, and it was an important reminder that we need boundaries. Boundaries are not so much to keep other people away, it's to keep ourselves safe and to set limits of where and how much we're going to reach out. To know when we have to retreat or move away to find safety, to find peace of mind. This is an integral part of the metta practice in the world with other people, is knowing when it's time to move on, knowing when it's not going to be received, knowing when kindness or when openness is simply bringing ourselves unnecessary suffering in that situation. It doesn't mean we just drop compassion, it means we move on to a different situation where we can experience a fruitful, compassionate interaction. As they say in Al-Anon, we don't go to the hardware store for orange juice. We leave the hardware store and we find a grocery store. So it's very important to know when you're in a hardware store. It's very easy to lose the focus of the walking meditation and the peace. We get caught up in the rush of accomplishment, trying to get here, there, trying to, you know, further ourselves, get to the goals. We're in our normal lives, we're always trying to get somewhere, and the present, where we are, is always seen as, you know, right now, it's not a very important moment. You know, when I get my degree, when I finish this project, when I do this in the future, then I have a right to relax and be peaceful. But right now, I've got to get to work. I've got to get there. It's very important to change now and then our habits. Take a different route to work. Change something about the way we are, the practices we have at home, to bring that sense of awe and newness once again into our lives, to make us, force us to re-explore the sensations of our lives. It's important to, if possible, leave more time so that we don't have to do the zombie-like walking meditation. We can do, though, a getting to places at a slightly slower pace where there's more awareness of the actual sensations that are occurring, where the mind is less racing ahead of the body and is, in fact, in the body. We still can get to work. We still can get to the places we need to go. But if we leave a little bit more time, if we just slow down a little bit, very often that tendency to completely abandon the heart, abandon the body, doesn't need to happen, or at least as quickly as it happens. But so often, after retreats, people just find the next day that they're back in the stress. So these tools are really important, because that this idea that it only can, the peace and the openness and the work can only be done here, it's not, that's not necessary. We can bring peace with us. We have so many stressful obligations and responsibilities. It's really important to stop once in a while. Reflect on the not only the work that you've done here, to remind yourself that there is an entirely different ground to your life, but to also appreciate the skillful, generous deeds that you've done to yourself, towards others. And as much as possible, this tendency to try to carry around in the mind all those things that we need to accomplish, all our goals. I've got to do this in my life, and I've got to do that, and I've got all these things. As much as possible, to simply carry around the barest minimum, just what you need to do in a morning, just what you need to do this afternoon. But the whole story, the arising of self, I am this and I've got to become that and I've got to achieve this and I've got these responsibilities and these obligations and all that, that's baggage. That's heavy stuff. That is dukkha. The stories and agendas, these are, the mind wants to tell you that these are the things that keep us on track and make us good people and make us worthwhile. It's not. It's not bringing clarity to the heart, and it's not making us accomplish anything. It's simply the stressful weight we carry around that chains us, that doesn't allow us to truly become present, to truly become open to our lives. Obviously, maintaining the practice, as I said. But what about the Dharma? You've been hearing Dharma talks. You might even be interested in learning more about this practice. Not only how it's done, but an overview of what the Buddha taught. I don't encourage you to run out and buy books, although I hear Dharma Punks is a very fine book. In fact, I've read it. But I do encourage you very much to use the resources that are magically now available to you. Very much another core part of my practice is that I daily, every day of the year, listen to a Dharma talk by a teacher I admire. This is the 40 minutes of the day that whatever has populated my mind, whatever stories about myself or stories about other people or memories that have suddenly arisen, there's time to acknowledge and to send compassion and to feel what needs to be felt, but there's also time as well to go to the Dharma and to plant the voices of wisdom in our minds so that we have other ways of perceiving life, other ways of finding a purpose, other ways of evaluating who we are, other ways of giving importance or a lack thereof to our experience. So I actively encourage you to either listen to audiodharma.org, which is a repository of great lay practitioners, or my favorite, Birken, B-I-R-K-E-N, which is the largest 3,000 taught library of Thai forest monks. Probably would be best to mix it up. There's wonderful teachers. Tara Brock, Noah, Pablo. Talks are online and available. And when I started practicing, we had to trade CDs and actually cassettes. I have cassettes. Now you can just push, type it out, www, I'm fucked up, give me the Dharma. So I think, just to review, and then I'm going to open it up to questions for all the teachers. Spiritual practice is not another ball we juggle. It is the foundation that allows us to live with peace in our lives. It is the absolute comfortable chair that we rest in so that all the other stuff that we want to accomplish and achieve and keep up in the air, that we can do that without losing our minds. And give it that priority. Just like the priority we give to our sobriety. Sobriety, for those who are addicts, is the single focus that allows us to live the rest of our lives. So too is spiritual practice the foundation of sanity for us. Practicing bringing awareness to the body, sensations that are occurring during the habitual ingrained moments, the showering, the waiting for the subway, before stressful meetings, relaxing the body. Greeting obsessive and repeating sensations with, welcome, yes, you're happening, this is what's happening now. Taking more time in our lives. Not rushing, but trying to move at a slightly slower pace. Embracing all the moments in between the important meetings and the important events. No moment in life should be seen as just an empty waiting space. It's an opportunity for practice. Changing ingrained habits at times. Pausing to sense the sensations after work. Practicing compassion, but wise compassion, with equanimity. Dropping the huge to-do lists of what we need to accomplish in our lives to feel that we're worthwhile. And checking in with our groups, our meditation groups, with our practice, with the Dharma talks we listen to. It's been an honor to be a part of this retreat. I'm very grateful, particularly to Noah, to extend the invitation. I'm not an experienced retreat Dharma teacher. I just teach on the Bowery and in Greenpoint to whoever shows up. In whatever shape they're in. And so my talks tend to be a little bit more trying to make it all sound attractive. They're not anywhere near where they should be to be the pure retreat Dharma talk. But Noah has, through his generosity, invited me to practice so that I can add to my toolbox some tools that are new. You've been kind enough to listen for these last two retreats. And with that, I'm going to just thank you for listening. Hope there was something of value in there. And now it's your turn to ask questions to whoever you want or share your experience.